And right now, Flora is here. Hi, Flora Lichtman's here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got this week?
This one sells itself. Okay, let me just set it up for you.
Sells itself like a big squid.
Yeah, exactly. It's the equivalent of a big squid for us. Fluorescent dye in the veins of leaves.
Whoa.
Just imagine that. And then you can go to the site and watch researchers sort of inject fluorescent dye into all these different leaves. And what it shows is the vasculature, the venation of the leaves underneath their surface. It's beautiful.
I was going to say that. I saw the videos on sciencefriday.com, on a video pick of the week up there in the left corner. And they watch the, you know, it reminded me of a really fancy, remember the old celery in the water experiment and the colored water experiment?
Actually, the researchers, who are two physicists, Marcelo Magnasco and Eleni Katsifori at Rockefeller, said, you know, if you have a high school education in biology, right, you could easily recreate this experiment yourself with something like celery or other plants.
Yeah, but they've done it with some gorgeous leaves. And what have they discovered about why the leaves do what they do with this stuff?
Well, they're interested in, from a sort of physics math perspective, of this pattern, the pattern of veins beneath the leaf. And the premise of their work is sort of that evolution has molded this geometry, and that this geometry is sort of the best solution or the optimal answer to the constraints on the leaf. And so what they're trying to figure out is what constraints create this sort of beautiful pattern in the leaf.
Why a leaf would choose to make that kind of pattern over another.
Why go left here and then right? And specifically, they looked at lemon leaves. And lemon leaves have this sort of beautiful looping structure. So the point is that it's not just an efficient tree where you have a direct path to one point on the leaf. You have lots of different paths. And under the rules of the economy of scale, that's not the most efficient way. So why do we have these loops in the veins? And they think that you can sort of look at this from a mathematical perspective to understand.
And they found from looking at your video that the straight line is not the best. It's not the healthiest for a leaf to have the veins go in a straight line.
Right. And you can imagine if you have damage to one of those veins, which we see in this video, you want other paths to get to the tip of the leaf. I mean, if you only had one path and then you damaged it, the leef would be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
What the video shows is exactly all these sort of looping, interconnected
paths. And they're gorgeous. You have different kinds of leaves from different plants. Right?
Yes, lilies and roses just for Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day.
I say Rosa on there. I saw that one. Yeah.
Yes.
And lilies and roses, and there was...
And lemons.
Lemons.
Oh, and one more, which is sort of the interesting exception, which is that ginkgos, which are really ancient plants, don't have this looping structure. So, you know, you can survive without it, apparently.
So, but perhaps this was, an evolutionary speaking, a better leaf pattern, right? If it's to go in a circle, then go in a straight line.
It seems like that could be true. And, you know, they're physicists, so they're hesitant to make any biological claims, but that may be.
It's gorgeous.
Thanks.
And if you want to see... this is our Science Friday video pick of the week. It's Flora's video, and she made a gorgeous one over there. We've done that. Where do these leaves happen? Who's doing these experiments?
It's at Rockefeller.
It's Rockefeller University here in New York.
Yep.
And you can see them as a video pick of the week up there on sciencefriday.com up there in the left corner. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, our video producer. That's about all the time we have for today. Christopher Intagliata is one of our producers besides Flora. And so we have a senior producer, Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our Sci Arts producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director and spinning the dials, pushing the levers and making sure we sound okay right here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com where we have the video pick of the week and dozens of them. And also, we have podcasting and blogging. And if you didn't hear the show today, you can pick it up on a podcast. And we have our videos on the podcast, too, and a new iPhone app. You want to watch the videos? You want to listen to Science Friday? You can take them on our iPhone apps. Also with us today is Alicia Bayek. So we're just about done. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Now a bit of sweet advice heading into Valentine's Day. Desserts have come and gone over the years, from Jell-O molds to frozen yogurt and most recently, the cupcake. Well, some foodies say another treat is poised to be this decade's defining sweet. NPR's Netta Ulaby visited one bistro in Alexandria, Virginia that's saying bonjour to the macaroon.
In the kitchen of Restaurant Eve, the cooks are chilling chocolate, proofing bread, and cleaning dill. And one of them is making macaroons.
Whisk it up quickly, but not too quickly.
The executive pastry chef of Restaurant Eve is Ed Holoka. He's blending egg whites and sugar in the service of a dainty French cookie that looks like a fancy little moon pie made with almond flour and flavoring.
It should be crispy on the outside, slightly chewy on the inside, and then it should have just a nice, smooth filling.
A filling cupped by shiny shells of airy meringue. Maybe it's buttercream or jam. Holoka's macaroons look like colorful round pixels of flavor.
Lavender and rosemary, sea salt and olive oil, blood orange pistachio.
Demand for macaroons has spiked in the past few months, says Holoka, a trend noted also by Amanda McClemens on her food blog, Metro Curion.
I've sort of noticed that the macaroon is popping up partout, as they say, in France, everywhere.
Everywhere meaning high-end restaurant dessert menus, Starbucks in limited editions, and on the rapidly followed television show, Gossip Girl.
I was in Paris. But only to get your favorite macaroons from Pierre Hermé.
Gossip Girl is kind of putting the macaroon in the spotlight.
McClemon says Gossip Girl just might do for the macaroon what Sex and the City did for cupcakes. It seems that every slightly risque New York-style-obsessed show needs a signature treat.
I think especially for young kind of trend watchers, this has certainly been put in the forefront of their minds that what's a macaroon and where can I get one?
For some people, it's not cool enough just to eat macaroons. They have to make them.
All right.
That's why one cute young couple have come to the industrial steel kitchen of Washington, D.C.'s St. Regis Hotel for lessons on making macaroons.
Macaroons are the fashionable snack. So we're trying to get ahead of the curve on that.
Donald Stevens is a casual cook, like most of the students in the sold-out class. And they all need lots of coaching from executive pastry chef Fabrice Bendano.
You know how to hold the piping bag?
No.
All right, so you're going to use your right hand all the way on top.
Okay.
Small portions. Small portion.
The technique eludes 26-year-old Lindsay Einstein, who's been trying unsuccessfully to make macaroons at home.
Mine look like blobs of toothpaste, and his look like pink silver dollars.
In fact, after getting schooled in macaroons' intimidating secrets, like drying the almond flour and sugar together in advance and tempering the egg whites, Donald Stevens says maybe the cupcake needn't feel too threatened by the macaroon.
It seems very complicated to prepare, so I'm skeptical.
Still, macaroons have hit enough of a tipping point for the French to start mocking our newfound obsession for them. Restaurant Eve's pastry chef, Ed Holoka, says one of Paris's most famous macaroon makers thinks we like them because they look a little like hamburgers.
And he came up with this one macaroon just to kind of make fun of Americans a little bit, which is actually a ketchup macaroon. And he does put a little bit of pickles on it. He did it kind of, I think, as a joke, but it's become this really staple, popular macaroon.
Leave it to the French. For Valentine's Day in this country, Holoka suggests sticking to raspberry macaroons, or maybe white chocolate. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
And if you're adventurous, you can find the St. Regis Hotel's recipe for rose white chocolate macaroons at our website, npr.org. Domestic issues, including health care and the economy, have consumed President Obama's schedule over the past year. That's left little time for diplomacy abroad. And senior news analyst Daniel Shore says it shows.
Traditionally, presidents turn to diplomacy abroad as a relief from fractious contests at home. Unfortunately for President Obama, most of his foreign engagements in his first year plus have turned out unhappily. Early in his tenure, the president, who has honed his conciliation skills on community organizing, extended a friendly hand to adversaries around the world, starting with Iran. But every effort to dissuade the regime in Tehran from its nuclear enrichment program has so far failed. When the United States set a deadline for action, Iran responded with a mocking counter-deadline. Now the president threatens diplomatic and economic sanctions. But as to a military response, which Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been urging, not a word. That has contributed to unusual tension between Washington and Jerusalem, and efforts to restart the Israeli-Palestinian peace process lie dead in the water. Unlike Iran, which is believed to be seeking nuclear weapons, the hermit state of North Korea has nuclear weapons. Periodically, it agrees to discuss them, and periodically, it returns to testing them. The war in Afghanistan drags on, and the timetable for a phased withdrawal of American troops may be called into question. The same in Iraq, where a sectarian war aimed mainly against the Shiites exacts a steady toll. The president's widely acclaimed Cairo address to the Islamic world has not brought any great abatement in radicalization in the Islamic region. Normally, the White House could count on warm relations at least with our European allies. No longer. Mr. Obama has no particular tie to the leaders of Britain, France, and Germany. And when the White House canceled a scheduled trip to Madrid for a European summit meeting, the Spanish newspaper El País headlined, "Obama turns his back on Europe." President Obama came into office coasting on a wave of international approval, even adulation, that seemed to augur well for the exercise of soft power to overcome some of the long-standing conflicts passed on by the Bush administration. But in a year, Mr. Obama has found most of these problems resisting his efforts, and with diplomacy apparently no fun, he seems to have withdrawn to more familiar conflicts like jobs and deficits. This is Daniel Shore.
Right now, Flora is here. Hi, Flora Lichtman's here with our video pick of the week. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have we got this week?
This one sells itself. Okay, let me just set it up for you.
Sells itself like a big squid.
Yeah, exactly. It's the equivalent of a big squid for us. Fluorescent dye in the veins of leaves.
Whoa.
Just imagine that. And then you can go to the site and watch researchers sort of inject fluorescent dye into all these different leaves. And what it shows is the vasculature, the venation of the leaves underneath their surface. It's beautiful.
I was going to say that. I saw the videos on sciencefriday.com, on a video pick of the week up there in the left corner. And they watch the, you know, it reminded me of a really fancy, remember the old celery in the water experiment and the colored water experiment?
Actually, the researchers, who are two physicists, Marcelo Magnasco and Eleni Katsifori at Rockefeller, said, you know, if you have a high school education in biology, right, you could easily recreate this experiment yourself with something like celery or other plants.
Yeah, but they've done it with some gorgeous leaves. And what have they discovered about why the leaves do what they do with this stuff?
Well, they're interested in, from a sort of physics math perspective, of this pattern, the pattern of veins beneath the leaf. And the premise of their work is sort of that evolution has molded this geometry, and that this geometry is sort of the best solution or the optimal answer to the constraints on the leaf. And so what they're trying to figure out is what constraints create the sort of beautiful pattern in the leaf.
Why a leaf would choose to make that kind of pattern over another.
Why go left here and then right? And specifically, they looked at lemon leaves. And lemon leaves have this sort of beautiful looping structure. So the point is that it's not just an efficient tree where you have a direct path to one point on the leaf. You have lots of different paths. And under the rules of the economy of scale, that's not the most efficient way. So why do we have these loops in the veins? And they think that you can sort of look at this from a mathematical perspective to understand.
And they found from looking at your video that the straight line is not the best. It's not the healthiest for a leaf to have the veins go in a straight line.
Right. And you can imagine if you have damage to one of those veins, which we see in this video. You want other paths to get to the tip of the leaf. I mean, if you only had one path and then you damaged it, the leaf would be in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
What the video shows is exactly all these sort of looping, interconnected
paths. And they're gorgeous. You have different kinds of leaves from different plants. Right?
Yes, lilies and roses just for Valentine's Day. Happy Valentine's Day.
Say Rosa on there. I saw that one. Yeah.
Yes.
And lilies and roses, and there was...
And lemons.
Lemons.
Oh, and one more, which is sort of the interesting exception, which is that ginkgos, which are really ancient plants, don't have this looping structure. So, you know, you can survive without it, apparently.
So, but perhaps this was, an evolutionary speaking, a better leaf pattern, right? If it's to go in a circle, then go in a straight line.
It seems like that could be true. And, you know, they're physicists, so they're hesitant to make any biological claims, but that may be.
It's gorgeous.
Thanks.
And if you want to see...
Not to me, to them.
This is our Science Friday video pick of the week. It's Flora's video, and she made a gorgeous one over there. We've done that. Where do these leaves happen? Who's doing these experiments?
It's at Rockefeller.
It's Rockefeller University here in New York.
Yep.
And you can see them as a video pick of the week up there on sciencefriday.com up there in the left corner. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Flora Lichtman, our video producer. That's about all the time we have for today. Christopher Intagliata is one of our producers besides Flora. And so we have a senior producer, Annette Heist. Charles Berkowitz is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Shelley Du Bois is our Sci Arts producer. Neil Rausch, our technical director, and spinning the dials, pushing the levers, and making sure we sound okay right here in New York. And we had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com where we have the video pick of the week and dozens of them. And also, we have podcasting and blogging. And if you didn't hear the show today, you can pick it up on a podcast. And we have our videos on the podcast, too, and a new iPhone app. You want to watch the videos? You want to listen to Science Friday? You can take them on our iPhone apps. Also with us today is Alicia Bayek. So we're just about done. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
And it isn't just Los Angeles having budget trouble. The whole state is in the throes of a full-blown fiscal crisis. But it looks like Californians may get the chance to vote on a novel way to help balance the books. The proposal? Legalize pot, then tax it. So how much money would that raise? Well, that depends on complicated economic questions like, what would a joint sell for on the open market? Here's NPR's David Kestenbaum with our Planet Money team.
Right now, the price of marijuana varies a lot. The government actually studies these things. Researchers go into holding cells where people have been arrested and ask questions like, what do you pay for marijuana? According to a report published in 2004, pot in some parts of the country can cost two or three times as much as in another.
If you're close to the Canadian border and can get, you know, Canadian bud, that's higher quality than ditchweed from Mexico.
Rosalie Licardo-Pacula is co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center. She says some of the differences in price are just differences in quality.
It's just like wine. There's really, really good wine, and there's mediocre wine.
According to that report, hydroponically grown weed in New York can go for $1,000 an ounce. The marijuana market is a real challenge for economists to understand. It's not a black market anymore, and it's not quite an open market either.
Yeah, we call it a gray market.
Over a dozen states now allow marijuana for medical purposes, but federal laws still ban it. And strange things can happen when a commodity crosses that border from illegal to legal. For instance, when states began passing medical marijuana laws, Pakula assumed the price for pot would drop. Because now, if you were growing the stuff, you didn't have to worry so much about being busted. You wouldn't need lawyers, guns, cars with secret compartments for smuggling. But this question has been studied, and it looks like the opposite happened. The price of marijuana actually went up. Pakula thinks the big reason is that when pot became legal for medical purposes, more people started using it. Increased demand, more people wanting something, tends to push prices up. Kevin Johnson is the general manager of a medical marijuana dispensary in San Francisco called Grassroots. The place is decorated like a turn-of-the-century saloon. And it does seem like more people are using marijuana these days to treat all kinds of things, like insomnia.
Insomnia, I'd recommend something heavier. any of the purple varietals tend to work very well for that. Say like purple Urkel or Granddaddy Purple or a purple Kush. Those tend to be much dopier and sleepier.
Now, in a normal economic market, when demand goes up, suppliers, in this case pot growers, would just grow more purple Kush and prices would come back down. But Johnson says the marijuana market is still quirky. Before running the marijuana club, he used to run a bar, which he says was completely different.
When you make an order for your supplies, for your booze, you know it's going to be delivered on time, and you can get whatever Budweiser or Jameson that you need for that week. Whereas in this industry, you'd never know when people are going to harvest. Sometimes they'll just disappear. You don't know if they just gave up growing or they went on vacation.
If marijuana were completely legal, big corporations might start growing pot super efficiently, and people think the price could come down by at least half. After all, pot is just a plant, not that different from growing tomatoes. And price is important, because the cheaper pot is, the more people will use it. And whatever you think about more people smoking pot, that could mean more potential revenue from a tax. California has estimated that a tax could bring in $1.4 billion in revenue a year, though some economists think that number is high. A few weeks ago, supporters of legalization and taxation in California turned in enough signatures to put the question on the state ballot in November. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to straightforward banking, including customer service with a real human being 24/7. Learn more at allybank.com.